later on once he's actually ascended the throne in about 1300. This is taken from. Now, Henry, having taken full advantage of conciliar passivity, had emerged triumphant from this crisis. Conversely, Montfort had become an isolated figure politically. Yet in victory, Henry forswore magnanimity, preferring instead to exact revenge. Montfort was to be tried for his recent defiance, his obstruction of the French treaty, and his acquisition of royal lands. The trial commenced in July, but proceedings were very soon suspended with the news that the Welsh had captured Wilf. This heavy defeat necessitated, it was argued, a full military response, the success of which would depend in very large measure upon Montfort's own widely respected martial skills. Thus, the inconclusive trial was postponed until October. Ultimately, the campaign was cancelled, but had offered Montfort a much-needed respite. For almost 3 months, he kept out of the limelight, staying away from court and distancing himself from the council's activities. Officially, the council retained full control over government policy, but since the late spring, it had been losing ground to the king. Yet all was not lost, as Henry still lacked the strength to overthrow the provisions in their entirety. Montfort therefore conceived an alliance that would allow him to re-enter public life. Shortly after the October Parliament opened, he made a surprising reconciliation with his bitter adversary, the Earl of Gloucester. Edward immediately joined them. This new partnership caught Henry entirely off guard, and soon the trio had seized control of the political agenda. Of particular concern to Montfort was his trial, the continuance of which had been pending since July. In light of the new politics, however, Henry was powerless to pursue his enemy any further, and proceedings were very quietly abandoned. The council underwent a limited purge, and all three key ministers of state were replaced in what constituted a clear reaffirmation of the principle of conciliar control over appointments. Occasioned through a swift but peaceful coup, the October 1260 Parliament witnessed the public reassertion of the principles that underpinned the reformist movement. Yet within 2 months, the council had effectively ceased to function. Fewer conciliar acts were issued as the weeks progressed, the rate of decline developing exponentially as the year's end approached. No new reforms were enacted, although on the 24th of November 1260, a new heir was commissioned. Tellingly, this was not a revival of the special heir with all its attendant powers to enforce the provisions, but an ordinary general, old-fashioned general visitation. The council's final order was issued on the 28th of December. This rapid collapse had been precipitated in part through the trio's dispersal. Edward had departed immediately after the Parliament ended for Gascony, where he indulged in his passion for jousting. Montfort headed for France, while Gloucester ceased to attend council meetings. Yet even now, Henry was still not free to rule in accordance with his own wishes. The council may have been subverted, but the provisions themselves remained fully in force. Many moderate reformers may have balked at Henry's aggressive defiance, or Montfort's aggressive defiance, but their personal enthusiasm for the reformers' project remained undiminished. In their localities, the desire for reform and the redress of grievances still burned brightly. But the council's demise met with a very muted response. There were no widespread protests, nor did anyone attempt to mobilise public opinion in its defence. Throughout that winter, Henry avoided issuing instructions that seemingly contradicted the fiction that he intended to uphold his promise, to observe fully the ordinances of the war of his council. This regal subterfuge proved highly effective, as the clandestine planning for a royal recovery continued apace. Henry's primary concern now was to secure a papal absolution from his oath to observe the provisions of Oxford. Without it, he would have been vulnerable to the most serious of moral charges, perjury. Nor was it just Henry who required absolution. Anyone who had been obliged to take the oath against their will would need to be released from the vow. In late January 1261, therefore, Master John Mansell set out for Rome to persuade Alexander IV to grant the requisite papal bull. The papal bull is actually the seal of the papal document. The actual documents are attached to the one you can see on display here. Henry meanwhile regained control over the chancery, a move that enabled him to issue writs and orders on his own authority once more. Henry's summoning of the Candlemas Parliament, held at the season specified in the Oxford provisions, enabled him to claim that he's still honouring the reformers' enterprises' tenants. But in a highly symbolic act, the venue was switched from Westminster to the Tower. Many barons objected, demanding instead that if it pleased the king, they would come to Westminster, where parliaments were accustomed to be held and not elsewhere. The initiative, though, remained with Henry as he went on the offensive. Berating the Baronial reformers for their self-interest, he attacked them for failing to deliver upon their promises. Office holders, he claimed, had put personal profit before public service, while the barons had demonstrably failed to restore the public finances. More serious was his accusation that the council had treated him as a minister rather than a lord. Soon these initial complaints had been transformed into written critique of the council's conduct. Negotiations quickly followed. On the 14th of March 1261, Henry agreed to submit his grievances to arbitration. Three arbiters would be chosen, one by each party, the third being nominated by the appointees themselves. Easter was a deadline for the decision. In his submission, Henry cleverly preserved the fiction that he was still willing to rule in accordance with the provisions. Thus, instead of mounting a direct attack upon the reformists' enterprise, he pursued the argument that the council surpassed its authority. The 15th's response was very robust, and several charges were firmly rejected. In reply, for example, to the accusation that they had consistently ignored Henry's advice, the councillors answered somewhat sarcastically that should only be heeded when he talked sense. Occasionally, they admitted the validity of his assertions, but countered with the justification that the encroachment had been an essential element in the reformers' programme that he had sworn to accept. Yet even as Henry was publicly engaged in negotiations, he secretly prepared for the provisions' overthrow. Gifts were given to prospective supporters, while foreign mercenaries were recruited. Henry similarly devoted considerable attention to healing the rifts within the wider royal family, as reconciliation between the Lusignan and Savoyard factions would significantly bolster his position. Everything was in place when, in late May 1261, Mansel returned from Rome. The mission had been successful, as the papal bull offered everything that Henry had asked for, his relief from his oath, as well as the statutes and ordinances made on the pretext of reforming the realm. His moment had finally come. At Winchester, amid the Whitsuntide festivities, Henry proceeded to publish the bulls. Henceforth, he declared, he would no longer recognise either the council or any of the reformers' legislation. Henry's dramatic announcement at Winchester on the 12th of June 1261 represented the conclusion of more than 18 months of careful planning. Through a judicious mixture of guile and deceit, the council had been vanquished, while the Lusignan's return had met with little opposition. Yet the Winchester coup did not presage the reform movement's rapid descent into political obscurity. Henry's manifest duplicity galvanised a fractured opposition into taking collective action. Urgent messages were dispatched from Winchester, calling for the barons to assemble there with arms to defend the reforms that they had won. Montfort and Gloucester, who were vociferous in their denunciation of the bulls, assumed joint leadership over the new emerging coalition. Its central core was formed from those militant reformers who had long followed Montfort's lead, but their ranks were now swollen as many moderates quickly joined them. Among the more high-profile returnees to the Baronial fold were Norfolk and Hugh Bigot, standing shoulder to shoulder with them the county gentry, who were now offering determined resistance to the Crown's officials in the provinces. Ever since the Oxford Parliament of 1258, there had been high hopes in the localities for both the scale and pace of reform. Judicial redress of grievances had long been promised, while local opinion was now formally constituted a dominant consideration in Shrewsbury elections. Several reformist enactments, such as the Westminster provisions, had been widely publicised and specifically addressed the county community's greatest concerns. In practice, though, the reformers found it exceedingly difficult to fulfil these heightened expectations. Yet, crucially, the associated blame was primarily directed against Henry. Thus, the Winchester coup acted as a catalyst that released the county community's long-suppressed rancour. On the 1st of July, the itinerant justices of Worcester faced angry protests when they attempted to open proceedings. Highly successful, this demonstration of communal solidarity directly challenged his reconstituted authority and helped bring the barons and local opinion into cooperative alignment on the question of the provisions. This was therefore the first manifestation of the political, powerful political alliance that Montfort would invoke frequently in subsequent years. Considerably more provocative, though, was Henry's replacement on his own authority of all the sheriffs to whom the counties had been committed by the barons and by the community of the realm. These collective appointments were an important step in reasserting Crown control over local government, which was the only element of the reformist project that had survived relatively unscathed after Winchester. For Henry, the dismissals were a logical milestone in the restoration of his personal authority, but in removing the one aspect of the reform movement that mattered most to the county community, they were highly inflammatory. There followed 3 months of upheaval in the shires as the people were aroused throughout England. Orchestrated primarily by Monfort, baronial keepers were appointed in many counties. Mainly local men, they were tasked with exercising the functions normally performed by the sheriff. In September, the barons summoned 3 knights from each shire to join them at St. Albans, where they would treat on the common business of the realm. Convening this proposed parliament on their own authority, it constituted a deliberate challenge to Henry's claims that he was now the country's undisputed ruler. Henry soon learnt what was being planned and acted swiftly to counter the threat an independent parliament posed to his authority. On the 11th of September, 1261, the sheriffs were ordered to direct the knights to an alternative venue. Uncertain which assembly to attend, it is likely that the majority simply remained at home. Henry now also confirmed the final arrangements for the arrival of foreign mercenaries who would bolster his military forces. Meanwhile, the unity that had characterised the baronial leadership since June was shattered with Gloucester's defection. Others soon capitulated as further resistance seemed futile, the consciences being eased with substantial bribes. Montfort himself was furious and left for France, scornfully declaring he would rather die landless than depart from the truth and be perjured. Effectively leaderless, the baronage reluctantly accepted a one-sided settlement in December 1261, known as the Treaty of Kingston, that effectively restored Henry's powers. Montfort alone remained defiant and publicly refused to submit to the terms imposed at Kingston. Bereft of allies, Montfort's prospects may have appeared bleak in the winter of 1261, but his uncompromising stance was to play handsome dividends in the long term. Untarnished by the collective taint of submission that afflicted his other rivals, Montfort could claim with justification that he was the only person prepared to risk everything in the provision's name. Over the coming months, therefore, he became publicly identified in the public's consciousness as a movement's sole leader. Exile in France, moreover, afforded him the opportunity to learn a very key lesson, that reform could be only be secured by the threat of force backed up by a willingness to use it. Henry, meanwhile, consolidated his control over the realm. 6 months after his abandonment in the face of vociferous opposition at Worcester, the general air was resurrected. Care was taken, however, to accommodate local sensibilities. For many with reformist sympathies, there are still many ominous signs that Henry had signally failed to learn the lessons of reform. New efforts were made to resurrect the Sicilian business, while the hated Lusignans had returned from exile. More worrying was Richard of Cornwall's decision, in an adjudication provided for in the Kingston Treaty, that Henry could once more appoint and dismiss sheriffs at will. Reversing one of the key demands of 1258, the reformist experiment now appeared to be over. Consent for Henry's policies was once again only sought from among his immediate circle, as the royal household quickly found itself divorced from the wider political community. Around him, they gathered a close-knit group of aliens and administrators that consisted primarily, but not exclusively, of Savoyards. The perception thus developed that Henry had surrounded himself with an all-powerful alien clique, dedicated to the provision's overthrow. Having emerged as the dominant faction at court, the Savoyards concentrated their efforts on the Marches' political emasculation. Holding them personally responsible for Edward's earlier estrangement from his parents, Queen Eleanor, who you can see behind me, was determined to punish them for their earlier conduct and embarked upon a campaign of harassment that was to transform eventually their resentment into a raging conflagration. Confident in the belief that his opponents had been vanquished, Henry now chose this moment to undertake another visit to France. Ultimately, this decision was to prove disastrous, but at its inception, at least, his reasons for going were very sound. Ostensibly, his visit was to resolve a few outstanding issues that had arisen from the Powers Treaty of 1259. Unfortunately for him, however, two events occurred that would significantly transform the English political landscape. Gloucester's death in July 1262 fatally weakened the long-term stability of Henry's newly restored regime, as removed the one noble with sufficient stature to counter Montfort's influence. Moreover, Montfort's successor was temperamentally very different from his father. Arrogant and prickly, the 18-year-old Gilbert de Clare would require some deft handling. Henry's reaction was anything but. Clare hoped that as a mark of favour, he would be allowed to enter into his inheritance despite being underage. But the frosty reception he received instantly soured relations. Believing he had been deliberately slighted by the king, Clare furiously departed for France. Yet even before Henry had time to rue his decision, Mother Nature herself intervened with devastating consequences for his personal authority. A fatal epidemic struck the English court while it was in France in September that left over 60 dead and Henry himself dangerously ill. Montfort's opportunity had come. On the 13th of October 1262, the magnates assembled in London for the Parliament's opening. Surprising them with his sudden appearance was Montfort, who had surreptitiously slipped across the Channel the day before. Ignoring the justiciar's protests, he proceeded to drop a political bombshell. In his possession was a new paper bull that confirmed the provisions in their entirety. Leaving his associates and supporters to digest the news, he swiftly returned to France. Montfort's intention was to sow disaffection and undermine Henry's authority. Such an outcome would obviously take time to achieve, so he waited patiently in France as the foundations of the royalist government slowly rotted away. Soon the Welsh marshes were in flames. Henry immediately left for England, but the pent-up dissatisfaction with his rule soon engulfed other shires. The provisions were reissued, but it was very much too little too late. Henry's authority was disintegrating rapidly, leaving in its place a political power vacuum. The disaffected were crying out for one man to fill it, and Montfort was the man who would do so. On the 25th of April, 1263, he stepped ashore once again on English soil. Montfort's immediate priority was forging a broad coalition dedicated to the provisions restoration. Oxford was the venue for the first meeting of this new disparate alliance. Convened without Henry's knowledge, the roll call the attendees highlighted just how formidable was the opposition to his regime. Some were committed reformers, while many more were Edward's former disgruntled confidants, the Marshes. Demanding that Henry actively enforce the provisions, they underlined their collective resolve of a thinly veiled threat of force. All who opposed the introduction of the reformist regime and programme were denounced as mortal enemies. Henry defiantly rejected the Baronial ultimatum. Acceptance would have reduced him once more to a mere puppet king, a condition he was simply not prepared to countenance. Henry's boldness in dismissing the Baronial demands were not a mere act of bravado, but rather a calculated gamble. He believed that his military strength would sufficiently overawe his opponents. Supporting him in this conviction was past experience. Whenever armed conflict had seemed inevitable, it was the barons who had blinked first. Yet Henry had seriously miscalculated on this occasion, and his refusal provided them with a sufficient justification for using violence to achieve their goal. Hereford was a scene of the initial outbreak of the revolt when, on the 7th of June 1263, the marchers launched a lightning raid on the city. Violating the laws of sanctuary, they brazenly seized its Savoyard bishop in the cathedral, along with several other alien canons. Such an audacious attack upon one of Henry's most prominent supporters emboldened others to join the nascent insurgency. Within weeks, the Baronial opposition had secured the line of the Severn. These were not sporadic and spontaneous outbreaks. The Marshes campaign was a very closely coordinated enterprise, the visible manifestation of a well-developed plan aimed specifically against those deemed to the provisions' enemies. Such selective targeting was deliberate and provided a unifying rationale that each of the coalition's factions could sign up to. Henry himself was completely taken by surprise by both the speed and the scale of the revolt. Lacking the military resources necessary to crush the initial insurrection, he had failed to prevent the total collapse of royal authority beyond the Severn and into the Welsh borderlands. Now he was confronted with the spectre of a countrywide rebellion that threatened to sweep away his hard-won political independence. Henry's response very quickly proved ineffective, and appeasement became the only option for him as his regime collapsed around him. For the second time that year, he reissued the Westminster Provisions. This stratagem failed as the barons had learned from long and bitter experience that only by relentlessly pursuing the military option would they propel him to the negotiating table. 7 days later, Henry retreated to the Tower of London, and here you can see an utter suppression of what the Tower looked like in sort of mid-13th century. Effectively besieged, the royal family's position was desperate as the London mob rioted through the city. Henry found he had little choice but to comply with the Baronial demands. Eleanor, though, was furious at her husband's meek acquiescence and formulated an audacious plan. Using the Thames as an escape route upstream to Windsor, On the 13th of July, she set out from the tower. News of her departure quickly spread, and a hostile mob gathered to prevent her passage. Seizing anything that lay to hand, they waited until her barge attempted to pass underneath London Bridge. Pelting the vessel with stones and eggs, the physical assault was accompanied by a stream of verbal abuse. Eventually, Eleanor was rescued by the London's mayor. But 2 days later, the barons entered the city in triumph. Montfort was now the kingdom's unofficial ruler. Sweeping to power through a combination of charisma, violence, and xenophobic propaganda, his reward was the opportunity to reorder England's government along the lines of his own making. All the ordinances and statutes from 1258 were once again confirmed by Henry. Accompanying this commitment to the provincial reform was a declaration that all the associated oaths were in future to be kept inviolably. Government would in future be only conducted, it was stated, by native-born men, faithful and useful under the Lord King, and not by others, as is done in common in all other kingdoms of the realm of the world. Novel though this was, it was the accompanying demand that all aliens must depart, never to return, save those who stayed, the faithful men of the kingdom might, with unanimous assent, accept, was truly radical. Heralding a new populist direction for the baronial movement, this call signaled a deliberate decision to exploit the wave of xenophobia they had been building for several years. Yet Montfort's regime proved to be very short-lived. The violence of the summer had alienated many in the counties, as the perception took hold that the baronial movement in 1263 was far removed from its roots. Instead of compromise and persuasion, its supporters had used the threat of violence to compel support. The clerical attacks had also triggered a wave of revulsion. Even those who were usually sympathetic to the reformers vociferously condemned those incidents. Montfort's success, moreover, had been built upon an unstable coalition that comprised several sets of malcontents, each of which had their own collection of grievances. Henry's capitulation meant that the fragile ties of self-interest holding the factions together quickly unraveled. This was especially true of the marchers. Lacking any ideological commitment to the provisions, the Savoyards' overthrow meant they could now rejoin Edward once more. Others, fearful of the increasing radicalization of Montfort's regime, were unwilling to follow him any further. The coalition's fragmentation thus marked a fork in the road travelled by the baronial movement since 1258. From this point onwards, only the most vociferous and ideologically committed advocates of reform would support Montfort in his increasingly bitter struggle with Henry. The king, meanwhile, employed a strategy identical to that followed in the spring of 1261. Publicly upheld the provisions, but secretly plotted their overthrow. Some were won over through bribery, while others were restored to favour. Gradually, Henry's political fortunes improved, and as the autumn progressed, the initiative passed increasingly to him. Montfort therefore accepted the French arbitration would probably be more profitable for him and was confident of a favourable hearing in France. Amiens was the agreed venue for the meeting that would be held convened in January 1264. Louis received written statements from both parties beforehand, the barons having invested considerable time and effort in drafting their submission. The latest theological teachings about the principles of consent and just rule were used to support their case. Concise yet sufficiently detailed, its author had cleverly linked the reformist movement's disparate grievances to Henry's violations of Magna Carta. Henry's argument centred upon the supremacy of the royal prerogative. Complaining that the barons had stripped him of the freedom to appoint his own officials, he emphasised that this had always been a power enjoyed by the crown. On the 23rd of January 1264, Louis delivered his verdict in an award called the Amis of Amiens. To the barons' dismay, he unequivocally supported Henry's position. Contending that the provisions had caused evil and strife, he announced a complete annulment. Henry's philosophy of kingship had been wholeheartedly endorsed. The stunned baronial delegation departed immediately for England, but whether they would accept such a one-sided verdict, only time would tell. Thank you.